Chapter 29. Agilis. When the physician in charge had examined me and found I had no need of treatment, he asked us to leave the lazarette, where my cloak and sword were, as he said, upsetting to his patients. On the opposite side of the building in which I had eaten with the troopers, we found a shop that catered to their needs. Together with false jewelry and trinkets of the sort such men give their paramours, it carried a certain amount of women's clothing. And though my money had been much depleted by the dinner we had never returned to the Inn of Lost Loves to enjoy, I was able to buy Dorcas a simar. The entrance to the Hall of Justice was not far from the shop. A crowd of 100 or so was milling before it, and since the people pointed and elbowed one another when they caught sight of my phylogen, we retreated again to the courtyard where the destriers were tethered. A port reeve from the Hall of Justice found us there, an imposing man with a high white forehead like the belly of a pitcher.
"You are the Carnifex," he said. "I was told you are well enough to perform your office."
I told him I could do whatever was necessary today, if his master required it.
"Today, no, that's not possible. The trial won't be over until this afternoon."
I remarked that since he had come to make certain I was well enough to carry out the execution, he must have felt certain the prisoner would be found guilty.
"Oh, there's no question of that, not the least. 9 persons died, after all, and the man was apprehended on the spot. He's of no consequence, so there's no possibility of pardon or appeal. The tribunal will reconvene at mid-morning, but you won't be required until noon."
Because I had had no direct experience with judges or courts, at the Citadel our clients had always been sent to us, and Master Gerloz dealt with those officials who occasionally came to inquire about the disposition of some case or other. And because I was eager to actually perform the act in which I had been drilled for so long, I suggested that the Kiliarch might wish to consider a torchlight ceremony that same night.
"That would be impossible. He must meditate his decision."
"How would it look?
A great many people feel already that the military magistrates are hasty and even capricious. And to be frank, a civil judge would probably have waited a week, and the case would be all the better for it, since there would have been ample time then for someone to come forward with fresh evidence, which, of course, no one will actually do."
"Tomorrow afternoon, then," I said. "We'll require quarters for the night. Also, I'll want to examine the scaffold and block and ready my client. Will I need a pass to see him?" The port reeve asked if we could not stay in the lazarette, and when I shook my head, we, the port reeve, Dorcas, and I, went there to permit him to argue with the physician in charge, who, as I had predicted, refused to have us. That was followed by a lengthy discussion with a non-commissioned officer of the Xenogy, who explained that it was impossible for us to stay in the barracks with the troopers, and that if we were to use one of the rooms set aside for the higher ranks, no one would want to occupy it in the future. In the end, a little windowless storeroom was cleared out for us, and 2 beds and some other furniture, all of which had seen hard use, brought in. I left Dorcas there, and after assuring myself that I was unlikely to step through a rotten board at the critical moment, or to have to saw the client's head off while I held him across my knee, I went to the cells to make the call that our traditions demand. Subjectively, at least, there is a great difference between detention facilities to which one has become accustomed and those to which one has not. If I had been entering our own oubliette, I would have felt I was, quite literally, coming home. Perhaps coming home to die, but coming home nevertheless. Although I would have realized in the abstract that our winding metal corridors and narrow gray doors might hold horror for the men and women confined there, I would have felt nothing of that horror myself. And if one of them had suggested I should,
I would have been quick to point out their various comforts. Clean sheets and ample blankets, regular meals, adequate light, privacy that was scarcely ever interrupted, and so on. Now, going down a narrow and twisted stone stair, into a facility 1/100 the size of ours, my feelings were precisely the reverse of what I would have felt there. I was oppressed by the darkness and stench as if by a weight. The thought that I might myself be confined there by some accident, a misunderstood order, for example, or some unsuspected malice on the part of the Portreeve, recurred, no matter how often I pushed it aside. I heard the sobbing of a woman, and because the Portreeve had spoken of a man, assumed that it came from a cell other than the one that held my client. That, I had been told, was the third from the right. I counted 1, 2, and 3. The door was merely wood bound with iron, but the locks, such is military efficiency, had been oiled. Within, the sobbing hesitated and almost ceased as the bolt fell back. Inside, a naked man lay upon straw. A chain ran from the iron collar about his neck to the wall. A woman, naked too, bent over him, her long brown hair falling past her face and his, so that it seemed to unite them. She turned to look at me, and I saw that it was Agia. She hissed, "Agilis!" And the man sat up. Their faces were so nearly alike that Agia might have been holding a mirror to her own. "It was you," I said. "But that is impossible." Even while I spoke, I was recalling the way Agia had behaved at the sanguinary field and the strip of black I had seen by the Hipparch's ear.
"You," Agia said. "Because you lived, he has to die."
I could only answer, "Is it really Agilis?" "Of course." My client's voice was an octave lower than his twin's, though less steady. "You still don't understand, do you?" I could only shake my head. "It was Agia in the shop, in the Septentrion costume. She came in through the rear entrance while I was speaking to you, and I made a sign to her when you wouldn't even talk of selling the sword."
Agia said, "I couldn't speak." "You would have known it for a woman's voice, but the cuirass hid my breasts and the gauntlets my hands. Walking like a man isn't as hard as men think."
"Have you ever looked at that sword? The tang should be signed."
Agilis's hands lifted for a moment, as though he would have taken it still if he could. Agia added in a toneless voice,
"It is. By Jovinian. I saw it in the inn."
There was a tiny window high up on the wall behind them, and from it, suddenly, as though the ridge of a roof, or a cloud, had now fallen below the sun, a beam of light came to bathe them both. I looked from one aureate face to the other. "You tried to kill me. Just for my sword." Agila said,
"I hoped you would leave it. Don't you remember? I tried to persuade you to leave, to flee in disguise. I would have given the clothes to you, and as much money as I could."
"Severian, don't you understand? It was worth 10 times more than our shop, and the shop was all we had."
"You've done this before. You must have. Everything went too smoothly. A legal murder,
with no body to wait for guile. You're going to kill Agilis, aren't you? That must be why you're here. But you didn't know it was us until you opened the door. What have we done that you're not going to do?
Less stridently, her brother's voice followed Agius.
It was a fair combat. We were equally armed and you agreed to the conditions. Will you give me such a fight tomorrow?
You knew that when evening came, the warmth of my hands would stimulate the Avern, and that it would strike at my face. You wore gloves, and you only had to wait. In reality, you didn't even have to do that because you had thrown the leaves often before.
Agilis smiled. So the business of the gauntlets was a side issue after all.
He spread his hands.
I won. But in reality, you won by some concealed art. Neither my sister nor I understand. I have been wronged by you 3 times now, and the old law said that a man 3 times wronged might claim any boon of his oppressor. I grant that the old law is no longer in force, but my darling tells me you have an attachment to times past, when your guild was great and your fortress the center of the Commonwealth. I claim the boon. Set me free.
Agia rose, brushing the straw from her knees and rounded thighs, as though she realized only now that she was naked. She picked up the blue-green brocade gown I remembered so well and clasped it to her.
I said, "How have I wronged you, Agilis?
It seems to me that you have wronged me, or tried to.
First by entrapment.
You carried an heirloom worth a villa about the city without knowing what it was you had.
As owner, it was your duty to know, and your ignorance threatens to cost me my life tomorrow unless you free me tonight. Secondly, by refusing to entertain any offer to buy. In our commercial society, one may set one's price as high as one wishes, but to refuse to sell at any price is treason. Agia and I wore the gaudy armor of a barbarian. You wore his heart. Thirdly, by the sleight with which you won our combat. Unlike you, I found myself contesting powers greater than I could comprehend. I lost my nerve, as any man would. And here I am. I call on you to free me. Laughter came unwished for, carrying with it the taste of gall. You're asking me to do for you, whom I have every reason to despise, what I wouldn't do for Thecla, whom I loved almost more than my own life? No. I'm a fool. And if I was not one before, surely your darling sister has made one of me. But not such a fool as that. Agia dropped her gown and threw herself toward me with such violence that I thought for an instant she was attacking me. Instead, she covered my mouth with kisses and, seizing my hands, put one on her breast and the other upon her velvet hip. There were bits of rotten straw there still, and on her back, to which I shifted both hands a moment later. Severian, I love you. I longed for you when we were together and tried to give myself to you a score of times. Don't you remember the Garden of Delectation? How much I wanted to take you there. It would have been rapture for us both, but you wouldn't go. For once, be honest. She spoke as if honesty were an abnormality like mania. Don't you love me? Take me now. Here. Agilis will turn his face away, I promise you.
Her fingers had slid between my waistband and my belly, and I was not aware that her other hand had lifted the flap of my sabretache until I heard the rustle of paper there. I slapped her wrist, perhaps harder than I should, and she flew at me, clawing for my eyes as Thekla used sometimes to do when she could no longer bear the thoughts of imprisonment and pain. I pushed her away, not into the chair this time, but against the wall. Her head struck the stone, and though it must have been padded by her abundant hair, the sound was as sharp as the tap of a mason's hammer. All the strength seemed to leave her knees. She slid down until she was sitting on the straw. I would never have guessed that Agia was capable of weeping, but she wept. Agilis asked, "What did she do?" There was no emotion beyond curiosity in the question. "You must have seen her." She tried to reach into my sabretache. I scooped what coins I possessed out of their compartment, 2 brass aurochocs and 7 copper E's. Or perhaps she wanted to steal the letter I have to the Archon of Thrax. I told her about that once. But I don't carry it in here. She wanted the coins, I'm sure. They fed me, but she must be dreadfully hungry. I picked Agia up and thrust her torn gown into her arms, then opened the door and let her out. She was still dazed, but when I gave her an aurochoc, she threw it down and spat at it. When I re-entered the cell, Agilis was sitting cross-legged, his back propped by the wall. "Don't ask me about Agia," he said. "Everything you suspect is true. Is that enough? I will be dead tomorrow, and she will wed the old man who dotes on her or someone else. I wanted her to do it sooner. He couldn't have prevented her from seeing me, her brother. Now, I will be gone, and she won't have even that to worry about." "Yes," I said. "You will die tomorrow. That's what I've come to talk to you about. Do you care how you look on the scaffold?" He stared at his hands, slender and rather soft, where they lay in the narrow beam of sunlight that had given his head, an Agia's, an aureole a few moments before. "Yes," he said. "She may come. I hope she won't, but yes, I care." I told him then, as I had been taught, to eat little in the morning, so that he would not be ill when the time came, and cautioned him to empty his bladder, which relaxes at the stroke. I drilled him, too, in that false routine we teach to all who must die, so they will think the moment has not quite come when in fact it has come. The false routine that lets them die with something less of fear. I do not know if he believed me, though I hope he did. If ever a lie is justified in the sight of the Pan-Creator, it is that one. When I left him, the aurochoc was gone. In its place, and no doubt with its edge, a design had been scratched on the filthy stones. It might have been the snarling face of Jurupari, or perhaps a map, and it was wreathed with letters I did not know. I rubbed it away with my foot.